and welcome to iDeveloper Live. Let's all say hello to Simon Wolf. Okay, hello folks, welcome to iDeveloper Live. We're no idea what episode this is anymore, because we have actually met. This is the third time we've met online and broadcast, but actually no show has made it out on the feed yet. Firstly, the first week because the show was just rubbish, and the next week because we were incompetent with
episode
the
N.
So this is our next attempt to episode N. On the show with me today, Mr. John Fox.
Hello, world.
Hello, John. It's good to see you in your robe again. Well, in fact, it's not good to see you in your robe. It's good to see you, but your robe is... No, just actually, if I say that, you might remove the robe, so we'll leave the robe where exactly where it is. And also with me, Mr. Graham Lee.
Hello, world.
Yes, see, so that's the beautiful tones of Graham Lee. Now, we can't remember what we've broadcast and not broadcast, so we're just going to go with this. Actually, we're broadcasting on a Tuesday today as well, which is unusual. So, basically, the world is a screwed-up place.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, cats and dogs raining from the heavens, fire and brimstone lying with one another, and so on.
That's right. And you know what also might happen then in that case is it's rumored.
If it really is the end of days, if the rapture is genuinely upon us, then it must be time for the white iPhone to be released.
Now, of course, by the time the majority of the world's audience listen to this, we'll know if that's true or not. Because the select few, the lucky few, who are listening live online right now,
both of them,
yes, they will know if we got these predictions right, whereas everyone else would just be either saying what do we care, we already know the announcement has been made, or you complete numpties, you were totally wrong.
I'm listening to this on my white iPhone and I can say you were wrong.
Yes, something like that. So John, you're going to be in the queue for a white iPhone?
No, I already have. I have enough white in my life. I've got a white robe and I am rapture ready as it is. I don't need these things.
So I think it would complement your robe quite well. Is the arrival of the white iPhone, if it does arrive in April tomorrow, is this why we're hearing the rumours that we're not going to see an iPhone 5 at WWDC? Because basically they're not going to release a new phone and then suddenly, what, 6-8 weeks later, make it redundant?
I don't know. I thought that the delay was related towards having, I forgot the name of the chip, but they had one chip that could do GSM and what's the other one? Whatever, UTMS?
CDMA.
CDMA, sorry, yeah.
So we're calling it a delay. Is it a delay or is this just a change? I mean, one of the reasons that Apple left Macworld is they didn't want to be forced to do a release every year when there was a conference. Now, but with the iPhone, they got themselves into that mess with WWDC, which, in fairness, isn't even a consumer conference. And most of the developers sit there and say, okay, let's get this press event out the way in the morning before we get onto tech content. And to me, WWDC would make far more sense if the morning was all about iOS 5 or Lion and what's coming and those sort of announcements. And actually, hardware was just left for special events another time. And maybe the iPhone went on to the sort of iPod type releases, because let's face it, iPod releases are now really secondary to iPhone releases. I mean, it's like, hey, we're doing an iPhone, and we're doing the iPod as well. So maybe that normal sort of fall event, which has got the freedom to move a little bit, will become the iPhone event. What do you think?
So my opinion is that if they had the iPhone 5 ready for release anytime soon, say within the next few months, then there'd be absolutely no point in releasing the white iPhone 4 at all, because it was supposed to come out at the same time as the as the black iPhone 4, and then they had these production problems that meant they couldn't make the thing. Well, it seems solving all of these problems and then putting the thing into production and distributing it just to then take it off the shelves 2 months later and replace it with something else. I don't see any point in doing that unless they think there's a large number of people out there who really, really want the white iPhone 4 and would buy it regardless. They may as well just make sure they get the iPhone 5 white from the start.
I don't know. I to be honest, I never really saw the appeal of the white iPhone. It just didn't do it for me. I mean, all things being equal, if you had the choice when you bought your phone, would you have gotten a white one?
Well, I don't know. It just wanted to be a little bit different. I mean, I thought the white iPhone in the original 3G looked quite good, actually. And so it was a But anyway, okay, I mean, I guess a more interest to us as developers is iOS 5. I mean, would we see iOS 5 being released on the iPhone 4, or is iOS 5 going to come along? You know, how tied do we think Apple are going to be to releasing the OS alongside the hardware, or are we also looking for that cycle to be sort of, well, I don't know, is that a cycle at the moment? Or no, they just seem to, they did 4 anyway, didn't they? Or that didn't have to wait for the iPhone 4?
No, and yeah, they typically don't, I think, release the iOS versions and the or at least the iOS major versions in sync with the hardware. I mean, sometimes there's like a point release. So yeah, I mean, you had iOS 3.1 on the iPhone and 3.2.
Dave, what are you doing?
We have no idea what Dave's doing. He's just across
like
the room.
You're complaining about my white robe, and I see, like, you know, Dave's plumber smile coming in frame. It's disgusting.
Shall I try and carry on and bring some decorum
please
to that this?
Dave's plumber smile isn't, will have to be edited out. Oh dear. Carry on, Graham.
Yeah, so when they released the iPad, they just brought out a 3.2. They didn't wait for version 4. And you know, they on the Mac hardware as well, they usually just bring out like a special build of whatever the current operating system is that includes the hardware support for the new kit. So I don't see the iPhone 5 and iOS 5 as particularly being, you know, products that have to come out at the same time.
So do you think that, shall we start now speculating wildly about iPhone 5 hardware, or and do you think that's going to bring the arrival of dual core for phone and iPad?
Well, I think the goal for iPhone, whether it's 5 or maybe 6, will be to get them as thin as the iPod Touch.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to see any resolution increase because I don't think it needs it.
I don't think there's any point now. You know, if they've made it as small as you can tell how big a pixel is, there's no point going smaller.
But we will see dual core chips as in the iPad too. So now I don't think we're going to see this necessarily with the 5, but you know, so as thin as the iPod Touch and dual core chips. And then really, we've got to be looking at a new product release of some sort from Apple, because what more are they going to do with it? I mean, this is why they need to get out of the yearly release cycle, because you cannot keep upgrading a hardware device in a radical way year upon year. I mean, because, you know, the innovation just isn't there. I mean, and it's no longer becomes, you know, radical. It just becomes what you're doing. And so I think, you know, they've got to get the iPhone down to probably, you know, the same sort of release cycle as the MacBook Air, 18 months, 2 years, in order to sort of now really let that device settle. And it's, you know, it's still going to sell bucket loads, isn't it?
And if they slow down the release cycle like that, then the white iPhone 4 now becomes the kind of, you know, the refresher to remind the market that these things still exist and they still do change them. You know, it becomes what people call in the Mac world the speed bump, the, you know, same kit but just with newer newer bits in it.
So how about this then? That just thinking this off the top of my head, springtime, February, you know, sort of March time is the sort of announcement time, like it currently is now, but we get on a sort of a rotating cycle of, you know, this year in spring we had the iPad, next year in spring we'll get the iPhone 5, and we won't see an iPad 3 for 2 years.
Springtime for iPhone and Johnny Ive. How about that?
Oh, God, it's horrible.
And we had the video.
I mean, the prediction. Right. Yeah, that's what we're supposed to be talking about.
Right, okay. I think that's going to be us. So, we have no idea. No one actually predicted if we would see the white iPhone tomorrow or not.
Very carefully not go on record saying whether it will or not, because I'll only look stupid afterwards.
Okay, so that's
as opposed to...
Possibly.
That's a possible yes, but maybe. Why not? Okay, that's fine. Graham was either just very clever there or very stupid. Okay, right. Let's talk tech, shall we? Let's talk tech, which means we need some music. Right, that was Coco Fusion music. Now, the Moneywell guys are still producing Moneywell 2.
Apparently.
So apparently that's...
In
that's,
white version that will be released.
In a white version due for release in...
Apparently some of the source code can only be written with TextMate 2. That's what I was told.
Yes. Mm. In a white font on a white background. So the debugging experience is there. So they're not with us yet. So we did the next best thing. We called somebody else, but they couldn't come either. And so we got Graham.
Glad to know I'm the backup plan for the next best thing.
Yes, that's it's there we are. So Graham, why are you sat next to me?
You just dragged my chair over here from the other side of the office, where I was preparing content for the video training course on test-driven development that we're writing, that we're filming right now.
Ooh, test-driven development. What's that?
Well, TDD. I shall tell you. Yes, as John Crowley says, it's abbreviated TDD. This is a way to use unit tests to help write code. In test-driven development, it's not just about using the tests to ensure that the software behavior is correct. What you're doing is using the act of writing the tests to help you understand the code that you're trying to write, and you know, to understand how you might want to use that code in an application. So you write a test, and of course that test will fail because you haven't written any code yet. But what the test encapsulates is your desire of how you want to use the code that you're about to write. And then, you know, once you've got that correct, then you can go in and fill in the implementation and make the test pass.
Right. John, are you a unit tester?
I mean, I don't write proper unit tests, but I was thinking about it this past week while I was writing something, you know, brand new for a client. And I regularly put in, you know, have these methods, test this, test that. It's not in a separate harness. It's actually in the code that I'm writing, and I tend to either remove it or comment it out afterwards. But where I'm trying to say, okay, I've got this one view controller, now it knows how to do it, and now I need to make sure that I can parameterize it and change the, you know, the layout of it and verify that changing the image or the background or, you know, whatever works. And then I have another one which is kind of a container which lays them all out and has to move from one to the other. And while I was writing it, I was doing all those things, and I have to admit, I'm becoming more and more interested in learning how to do it. You know, my lame excuse has always been that I could was always see how it's easier to do complete test for model classes, and seeing harder to be able to do it for view controllers, for example, where you have all this user interaction, and how do you write tests for doing that.
Ah, well, when he gets a copy of our course, he'll know about that, because we were covering testing view controllers today, weren't we?
I look forward to the royalties.
But one of the one of the things that we've been looking at as we've been filming this course today, this has been day one of filming, is the fact that actually when you look at, you know, when you write your code, you need to design your code for testing purposes. So really, one of the reasons it's quite hard to retrofit unit testing is because the code has not been designed to test. And actually, once you start looking at designing your code for testing, it becomes far more modular, far more broken down and less coupled and dependent. Now, we've been looking at OC Unit, which is part of Xcode 4. Now, OC Unit has been in Xcode for a little while. But let's face it, I think it's... Am I being unfair if I said, up until Xcode 4, the integration with OC Unit was fairly crap?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they'd given you the ability to run the tests automatically, and they'd bundled the framework, so you didn't have to go and download it from sente.ch. But other than that, that was really... it didn't really offer anything. So particularly debugging tests was, you know, very hard for a lot of developers. I think Chris Hansen from Apple wrote some blog posts about how to get the thing to stop in the debugger while your test is running, but it certainly wasn't straightforward.
It had something to do with hanging upside down from the ceiling while sacrificing a chicken.
And it only worked on, in the middle of June, yeah.
Yeah, if it's a full moon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and John's not wearing his robe. Yeah. So it's there. So, I mean, one of the biggest complaints, Graham, about unit testing is it just makes it so long, darn long to develop anything. Mm. But that's a lie, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly, you know, at the outset, it does seem like it's going to take much longer. Like, you've got to write all of these tests, and then you've got to write the code you were going to write anyway, so, you know, aren't you just doing more work than you had in the first place? and, you know, so let me tell you about my first experience with unit testing with a Cocoa application, which was trying to bring unit tests to an existing app which had, you know, multiple processes. This was a Mac application, some of which were running as root and could only run as root. There were bits in kernel extensions, user space processes, and so on. You know, this thing had just clearly not been designed with testing in mind whatsoever. So it to test one little bit of functionality, I wanted to check that it was picking up the locale setting properly from the operating system. It actually took me 3 days to pick the code apart to the point where I could run the class I was interested in isolation, you know, even before I could write any tests. And that, you know, that's really demoralizing. That's like, you know, three days that seemingly spent, you know, just sitting around doing nothing until I can get to the point where I can write some tests, and then I spend more time writing the tests, and then I finally write the code. But once I'd got to that point, that code was tested. You know, I knew that that worked, and I also knew that if I ever changed it and caused it to stop working, I'd be able to find that out as well. And, you know, now that I've been writing test-driven code for a few years, I find that you know, because it just helps me work out how I want to design my code, helps me think about what error conditions exist and, you know, how to take care of them, it takes about the same time to write code that it took when I wasn't writing tests. But now that I know that it works, and I know when I'm finished, whereas, you know, previously I just had to kind of go, well, I've written some code, it seems to do what I want, let's ship it and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the way unit tests come into their own, I mean, Uli Witness in the chat room has said, you know, how do people find the motivation to write tests? And actually, you know, in fairness, especially when you get that new project sort of freshness about you, and you just want to be writing code, to stop and write unit test frameworks and all the rest of it, it is disciplined, isn't it? You have to be disciplined. But, you know, it's not then that unit tests pay off. I mean, for me, unit tests is when I come back to my code base in 3 months' time, or I'm in version 1.1, 1.2, and I want to make a change.
Yeah.
I think Init Cursor in the chat room says, you know, he had to once modify just a few hundred lines of a 500,000 line project and then guess if it still works.
Right, right.
You know, to me, it's being able to go into my code, add the feature I want to add, change the feature I want to change, and then be able to sit there and be really confident. And I can say sometimes, you know, up to 100% confident, not always, but often, 100% confident that nothing I've just done is actually broken something. Yep. Or if I have broken it, I'm going to know that I've broken it because the unit tests are going to tell me if things still work as I expected them to work.
So yep. You can say the difference between TDD, test-driven development, and the old way of doing it, which is ADD, attention deficit disorder, where you have the freshness of a new project and say, oh, this looks like a fun thing to work on. Oh, that kind of works. Let's move on to the next part of my work. I think another way of putting it is like, if you actually care about maintaining the code in any way, you have any ownership of it, you have to do it. But I think the other thing is the tools could possibly get a little bit better by and I haven't looked at this yet, but I'm hoping that just like there's kind of starting code when you create a new view controller, they have commented out saying, hey, if you want to customize, here's, you know, do it here in view did load, or, you know, init with coder. So is there any possibility that when you create a new class that has some of the basic test farness methods built into it? Is that something that we might see, or does it exist? I haven't found it.
So the template test classes that Apple provide actually have far too much sample code, and I end up deleting quite a lot of it before I do anything. One thing that, you know, really annoys me about the way that they've done the template code, and, you know, I have filed a radar, so before everyone says in the chat room, hey, you should file a bug with Apple, I did. But when you create a new project, they automatically put a failing test into the template file. And you know, that just irks me because it means that you create a new project and it already fails. But yeah, they have the sample code for the setup and teardown methods, you know, for creating the environment that the test will run in, and they have the template test methods as well. So the information is already there, is supplied by Apple. In fact, the template file even includes a link to the online documentation about how to do testing in Xcode.
Nice.
I think one of the questions is, you know, what do you test? Mm. I mean, I've seen it taken to the extreme where people will test a property setter and a property's getter when the property is only been using the, you know, sort of synthesized thing, which, you know, doesn't do anything. Mm. I guess that has value because one day you may change the synthesize method to do your own implementation and the test will catch any problems you create. However, I guess testing, what's there? Some arguments say actually you only need to test external behavior.
Right.
And don't have to test internal behavior because internal behavior should be hidden and who cares.
So one of the kind of tenets of test-driven development is this phrase red, green, refactor. Which basically says that you write a test that fails, which proves that there's something you want your app to do that it doesn't offer yet. Then you get it to the green point is where the test passes. So you've demonstrated that you have actually added the behavior, the feature that you need. And then, you know, refactoring is when you edit it, tidy it up, do whatever you like without changing the behavior. And the fact that you've got all the tests in place makes it easy to do that because you can tell if you ever break anything. So if you're doing TDD by saying, how do I want to use this code, then you are automatically testing the external interface because, you know, there's nothing else to want to use other than the external API. If that's all working and then you decide I want to take this method out and break it out into like an internal helper method, then, you know, you're free to refactor it that way, and it's already being tested because all of your tests still work and still pass. So, you know, I don't tell people they need to test internal helper methods, that they need to, you know, break open the internal API of the class. Because if you're working in a test-driven fashion, then you should never have internal code that doesn't get run, you know, when you test the external API. You know, you can't possibly write anything that wouldn't get tested because you're only writing code in order to make it pass tests.
Mm. I think that makes sense. I think.
Let's see if anyone in the chat room agrees.
Yeah. Yeah. The chat room has gone really quiet, actually. Mm. Obviously, we're either incredibly interesting or they've all gone off to play cards.
You piqued my interest when you talked about, you know, that a lot of people start out with their new classes just with the basic, you know, property and synthesize. Mm. And I always worry that you know, I add a new property, then I forget to you know, release it in Dialloc, for example. And are there tests that will test those types of things, either in conjunction with you know, spacing here, the testing software, the one that tests memory leaks. Is there something along those lines that you can kind of assure that the basic creation and destruction of your class doesn't read, you know, it doesn't leave a memory leak?
I mean, the static analyzer is really the tool to use for that. I was having a discussion with a couple of people, including Bill Bumgarner, about testing retain counts, and kind of came to the conclusion that it's not really possible, but, you know, particularly if you're dealing with foundation objects, you would need to be able to tell how often you're calling retain, release, auto release, whether it balances, whether the libraries are sneakily doing something behind your back that you don't know about. You know, so take the simple example of a string property. You want to test that this retain property that is a string is actually retained. Well, you might go, let's see if the reference count gets bumped up by one, you know, during the execution of my test. then along comes a static string instance, which always has a retain count of NS not found, and so it doesn't get bumped up by one when you're running the test. So your test fails, except that your code is actually doing the right thing. So unfortunately, you know, testing retain counts isn't really something you can do inside unit testing. But you can, you know, as I say, rely on tools like the static analyzer to ensure that you're following the rules, you know, the Apple's memory management rules.
Yeah, I mean, and I think unit tests have to be seen as part of an overall testing and quality assurance strategy, don't they? I mean,
yeah.
I think we need to be running instruments, we need to be running the static analyzer. Mm. And in some ways, unit tests are... I always think of them as programmer-level functionality testing,
yes,
as opposed to debugging testing. Mm. It's say, you know, does this class do what I think I've written it to do?
Right.
You know, when I pass the add routine, you know, two numbers, does it add them together correctly? You know, when I say the create new customer, does a new customer end up somewhere? As opposed to, you know, are my variables named correctly? Are, you know, am I doing my Alex, the Alex correctly, whatever else, which, you know, again, is a lower level for a lower level tool. It's in there. So just take someone like John, okay? He has a version 2 product, unlike some people on this show who have not been around for a while. Okay, and so in his version 2 product, you know, there is probably quite a lot of code. I mean, because John, it's not a flashlight app memory miner. It's not sort of like, you know, a new project template and release it and then change the background color and do version 2. You know, that John would have a lot of code.
Yeah.
And he's not as yet unit tested, partly because some of the stuff might not have been available when it started. Secondly, it's not part of his workflow that he's had time to introduce. But, you know, you've whet his appetite enough today to make him think, yeah, well, you know, I need to be looking at this stuff, for example. Yeah. Okay, where should someone with an existing code base begin? Because you don't want to sit down, you know, if John was to try and sit down now and write full unit tests for Memory Miner, he will probably spend the next 12 to 18 months sat there, and I'm probably fairly safe saying that might not be the best use of his next 12 to 18 months. So what would you recommend someone like John did in order to start getting the benefit of unit testing without having to, you know, pay that price, as we say?
Sure. So you can kind of start adopting a philosophy of testable code and tested code as you're going. So, you know, let's say you've got your 2.1 product, and then someone files a bug report. Write a test that demonstrates that bug does exist. Write a test that would pass if that bug wasn't there. Then fix the bug. You prove that you have fixed it, that you have changed the functionality so that it works. That gets you, you know, a small amount of test coverage, but it's a start. And you probably had to pick some bits apart, you know, remove some dependencies in order to get that test in place. And now you know that you've got a test for if you ever regress that bug, you know, if you ever do some other change that reintroduces it, then that test will start failing again. So you've already added some value, and yeah, just carry on that way, incrementally adding the tests into the project. Next time you need to add a feature, where does it integrate with the rest of the application? Write tests around those sections while you're working on them. A project of I want to sit down and, you know, produce 100% code coverage on these 150,000 lines of code is, you know, A, a mug's game, and B, probably the most demoralizing thing you'll ever try to do. So, you know, just make it the way that you work. From now on, any code I add to this project will be tested.
That's a very good way of doing it, and seems doable. And I was just thinking while listening to you that maybe you could combine, you know, scripting of your app, which hopefully is your app is scriptable, and it is because you've made your app accessible. But I think about some of the when you were saying, okay, well, if somebody files a bug report, part of the thing is you're looking for the steps to repeat to get the app in that particular state. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, how would I do that? You know, let's say the bug was when I have a brand new library and I put in, you know, however many brand new cataloged photos, and then whatever, double click it in just this right way, then it causes some problem. You know, that have you ever thought about doing that, or ever seen that done where you combine Apple's, you know, script or some sort, like to get it to a place which then and making in that in some way part of the test suite?
So I have done that, but I don't consider that kind of part of unit testing.
No.
And the reason is that yeah, those tests definitely have value. Driving the entire test from like an Apple script, the entire app from say an Apple script interface, or just automate clicking on buttons certainly does have value. Those tests tend to be a bit more fragile in that if you make a change somewhere inside the application that might cause that test to fail, then you've suddenly got a failure on your hands, and you've got to look through the entire app's code from the point where the UI is clicked to the point where the bug occurs in order to try and locate it. That's one thing. The second thing is that execution of those sorts of tests takes a long time, and by a long time I mean about a second or possibly a bit longer. What you really want from unit tests is speed. You want every time you build, you want to run the tests. You want to have hundreds, potentially a couple of thousand tests by the time you've built up an entire app, running in a second or two, because you want very quick feedback. If it takes too long, then you're just going to like not do it because you don't want to sit around, or you're going to lose your train of thought while you're waiting for the tests to run. If the unit tests all run within a second or two, then you just get that very quick feedback of yes, I have added something without breaking anything else. Of course, that means it there may be some problems that it doesn't uncover, but the fact that you're able to get that feedback so quickly makes it a much more useful tool to have.
And what are the types of things that you're looking for? I mean, the other thing I was thinking about is, defensive programming. You have a method that says do something with this, and you check, well, have you passed in any value of this, or is this of the class that you're expecting it to be, or so on and so forth. And then if you do fail, then what do? Return nil, raise an exception, and kind of at what point are you testing that? Are you testing to see that a particular method responded in the right way, and then the caller is responsible for handling that, or how do you think about that?
Well, you get to choose which style you like. If you decide that calling a method with a particular value for the parameter should raise an exception, you get to test whether it does raise an exception in those cases. If you think that it should be the caller's responsibility, then you don't have to put that test into testing that particular unit. But when you test the calling code, you get to write tests that verify whether it does what it's responsible for. So it doesn't kind of force you to choose a particular paradigm for defensive programming. In fact, it doesn't force you to do defensive programming at all. You could just write unit tests for the happy case. But where you know that errors can occur and you know that they should be handled, you can write unit tests that A, express what you think should happen, and B, demonstrate that that does indeed happen. And that makes unit testing not only a valuable testing tool, but quite a powerful documentation tool as well. Because if you hand off some code to like a contractor or to a new employee, or someone else is working on your app, you can use that person can use the tests to help them understand what this class does and how it works and what it's responsible for and what code that's using it is responsible for doing.
There's been a few comments in the chat room, which I'd like to pick up on. One of them says, curious about techniques to write code that actually is testable. Mm. We've actually been looking at a few of these today.
Yeah.
One example that we looked at was, changing a method from just being a method with no parameters operating on a property of the class to actually taking the parameter it wanted to operate on. There were several reasons for that. The first is actually that method now becomes more flexible
Yeah.
Because you know, you can now make it work on a number of objects if you choose to pass it through. But secondly, it's just become a testable method, because in the testing environment, you can call that method, pass it an object, and find out what it did to it. Whereas if it was just using an internal object of the class, now when the class uses that method, it can pass it its internal object, its property, that's all fine. But we've just created a method that is now testable that previously wasn't testable because it was only using internal data. And it's, you know, that's, it's little things like that that actually suddenly make your life of testing a lot easier if you're just syncing in app mode. Another one on there is, how would you test code that relies on external dependencies like networking? Now, I happen to know that's the first thing we're filming tomorrow morning.
Yes, that's right.
Is dealing with unit testing and networking.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm interested to hear what you're going to tell me tomorrow. Just give us a brief overview.
Right. So, of course, what you want to try and do is to remove that dependency, because A, your unit test should be fast, and let's say that, you know, you're on the Bollockshire internet connection that we had this morning, and your you know, your download speed is 10 kilobits a second or whatever it was. You're not going to want to have to wait around for 5 minutes to download a file from the server. Let's say that the file is hosted on Amazon EC2 and is unavailable because their service has gone down.
Again.
Or that, you know, you're
trying to access EC2 from the Bollockshire.
Exactly. Or, you know, your DNS resolution has stopped working, or whatever one of myriad problems can occur in networking that basically stop the thing from working, even though there is no bug in the code. You either end up with tests that do run but are far too slow, or that start failing randomly. So you need to, as I say, remove this dependency on the network.
I mean, now, that's an interesting point, because you said tests that fail randomly. The point is, you have to know a unit testing to be, otherwise you stop using it. Is if a test fails, it's genuinely because something is broken.
There should
not because of some external factor that happens to be working today or doesn't happen to be working today.
There should be exactly two reasons for a test failing: either the test is wrong, or the test that it codes, the code that it tests, is wrong. And you would hope that you didn't get the test wrong, but either of those two cases is very quick to discover. Something random going on, like a database not having the correct values in it, or network resolution being down or something like that, is going to take you much longer to find and debug. So you don't want to have to deal with that in the 2 seconds it should take you to run the tests and to understand the output.
So I want to see if I understand you correctly, because like networking, a lot of people have classes for as a front end to NS URL request, for example. I'm going to go out and fetch some data from a web service, and you end up, there are delegate methods that NS URL request will do for indicating that you got a response, the response is finished, or you had an error, and then you have your wrapper class that has to handle those things, and likely you have a delegate that you want to inform of those things. So you end up having classes that things like handle network timeout, or handle this, that, and the other thing. So then you should be able to write a bunch of handle type methods, handle this case, handle that case, and then that you should be able to run right away. I mean, you can simulate a network failure in the test harness itself then, right?
Yeah. So essentially what you're trying to do is you want code that handles NSURL connection or whatever it is you're dealing with. And then you want to test, if the NSURL connection looks like this, or if this event happens, does my code handle that event properly or that state? And then if it does, then when you hook in a real URL connection object, it should, one that's actually communicating with the network and downloading data, you should be confident that your delegate class is doing the correct thing, because it handled all of the simulated cases correctly. But you don't... you don't need to actually cause a network timeout in order to see what happens in the case of a network timeout.
So is there a kind of, I don't know, 4 or 5 kind of states that you think about? I'm writing a brand new class, and maybe it's different for a view controller versus a model, but kind of what am I looking at? That the class is I've made an instance of it, test to see that it's returning what it's expecting to. I'm setting some data on it, or setting it up in a little bit. And then, whatever it is that it's doing, these are the 2 or 3 likely, states for success or failure or whatever, and then I'm destroying it and getting rid of it. So, I mean, do you kind of find yourself doing that when you create a new class?
So, to give an example of some real code, well, I say real code, it's actually demo code for a book on TDD that I'm working on at the moment. But this thing needs to communicate with the server, download some JSON from the server, and then convert that into an object. So I've got, for a start, I've separated these concerns out. There's a manager object that the application talks to get the work done. Then there's a communicator object that actually talks to the server and downloads the data. And then there's a builder object that takes this data and constructs the model objects I really need. So each of these things happens independently. Now I test that, do I get input in the way that I want it? Is my input expected? What happens in the case of errors? Then I test, what does the manager object do if the communicator tells it that it couldn't talk to the server? What do I do if it does talk to the server and does get data? Then what happens when the builder is sent data that actually doesn't look like the JSON it's expecting? Or it is JSON, but it doesn't contain the keys that it wants. Or it does contain the keys that it wants. Does it create the correct objects? Then, do I use those objects correctly? And so, at each step, I can break it down into what are the possible things that could happen. Not just does the success case work, do I handle errors, but what are those errors? What could possibly go wrong at this point? And for each of those, do I have error handling in place? Now, it could be, and indeed often is the case, that the error handling is the same, that this thing just realizes that getting the wrong data and not getting any data are actually going to be dealt with in the same way. It just means that I don't have anything to do now. But I've explicitly ensured that the app is handling each of these cases.
Well, you might also kind of make sure that what you communicate back is the same thing, because in the specific case of web services, as far as NS URL request is concerned, if the server responds with a 500, it's gotten the response and everything's great. But as far as your delegate is concerned, it's like, well, the web service I'm talking to is having an error, and that's a bad news. And in that particular case, you want a certain type of message that may get all the way up to the user saying, hey, sorry, but Twitter's gone sideways, or which is a very different case from, you're in East Ballockshire and you have no network connection.
But if you think about it, I think the point here is separating concerns. When I was writing a class the other day and it was going out across the internet, getting some data, coming back and processing it, and I said, okay, bad move, separate the processing out from the data collection, because now my unit tests, the class that, as you just said, that processes the data, I pump it model data, good data and bad data, and see what it does. Whereas the class that collects the data is a different issue. But of course, again, delegate methods are only methods on a class. And so therefore, in the test framework, you can say, okay, what happens if I throw an NS data comes in on here with a 500 in the status code? Because I can set that up in the test framework to call that method and see what happens. But again, logically breaking it down, I think, we can end up coding too often where we are assuming that this method is being called after another method has been called and a certain state is in place. And actually, that's pretty bad class design, because actually, unless it's a private method that no one else can get to and therefore is part of a code flow that cannot be made from outside, that method should be able to independently stand on its own.
And if you
can't test it because it can't stand on its own, that's a good indicator that your class design is becoming a bit scrappy.
Well, and in that case, so you can use assertions inside the production code. You can assert that the state is what you expect. So this is another example of where unit testing is a tool. It's a helpful tool. It's one of many tools, and there are other things you can use in connection with it or completely separately. So, for example, we talked today about the case of testing IB outlets and setting them up without using interface builder files. But what I find is the problem that I most often make when I'm working with IB outlets is that I create the IB outlet in Xcode. I create the the widget, the button or whatever in Interface Builder, and then I actually forget to set it as the outlet. So, you know, in those cases, what I usually do is in await from nib or view did load, assert that the outlet is non-nil. And that's not something that I'm testing for in the unit tests because I'm not using the IB file in the unit tests. But I'm still ensuring that that I've got this thing right by making my app crash if I got it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we were doing that as well. We were with the controllers today, where actually your unit test creates your view controller. But yeah, obviously it makes sure it sets the nib is nil and the bundle is nil. And then your unit test creates the buttons and whatever else and pumps them into the outlet properties. So you now have access to the test and can test that your methods in your on your view controller operate on the outlets in the correct way.
So, you have full control over the object state. So if there is a method that relies on a particular state, then you can set that up. It may be better OO design to use like the state pattern or the strategy pattern to do that kind of thing. But if the way you've designed the class requires something to be set up before your code runs, then you can set that up in the test framework as well as in the app.
John, you were going to say something, then I'm going to go to another question from the chat.
Well, that's actually what I was doing. I'm saying we've got some questions that we want to do. So Uli was asking about eggplant. And I've never heard of it. Have you?
I have. Eggplant is an application. I can't remember the company's name. Is it Redstone Software? Someone will be able to find out in the chat room and post it up. It's an automatic graphical user interface tester for Mac apps. And the way that it works is effectively over VNC. You create a VNC connection to a computer, and then you drive the application's user interface through that. Okay, so apparently Redstone is correct. So you write these scripts that are based on moving the cursor to a particular point or to a particular image that it searches for on the screen, and then click on that image, and then this other thing should happen and be visible. So it's a way of doing integration testing, of testing the entire application by driving the user interface. I haven't used Eggplant itself, but I've used similar tools for doing that kind of high-level stuff. And it's amazing how fragile they are, actually. Like, we had some tests on one app that I wrote that worked fine on 10.4, but broke on 10.5 because the colours of some, of like the window chrome had changed, and the thing could no longer detect the images. And so, you know, upgrading the operating system meant spending some time fixing the fixing all the tests to get them to start working again. So that kind of stuff. And you know, the instruments has an instrument in for doing automatic iOS app GUI driven testing using the accessibility APIs, which is a more robust way of doing it, because you are relying on kind of the programmatic content of the app telling you which controls are where and what you're trying to drive. As I said, they can be quite fragile. They often end up being harder to debug than unit tests, because all you know is that at some point between the view and somewhere deep down in the bowels of the application, something went wrong, but you don't know where it is until you go and look. But they are still valuable tests, and so it's useful to run them, say, before you release a new version of the app. But you probably don't want to be running them every time you build the product.
Apparently, the company recently renamed itself to TestPlant. We've just seen in the chat room. Whether that's right or not, I'm just repeating what's in the chat room. Sue me.
You're adding real value there, Scotty.
Thank you. I knew I was here for a reason.
Well, you have a warmer sounding voice than some of the text-to-speech models that ship with the OS.
Okay, well, that's right. Init cursor, can code coverage analysis tools be usable in unit testing? ?
Do you want me to answer that question, or are you just trying your Tron voice?
No, I don't think
voice,
that's a good idea.
Okay, so...
That was my Alex voice, by the way. It wasn't very good, though, was it?
No. So, code coverage analysis is something that I very deliberately do not do. I don't see the... there are limited circumstances where I can see the utility. If you are working on, you know, it, bringing tests into an existing app and you want to see how far you've got, then code coverage is useful. If you're working with a large group of developers and you want to make sure that they are all following the group policy, if you like, on doing unit testing, then code coverage can be useful, but it's quite easy to game so that you get increased coverage without actually testing anything. If you write a test that runs some code and then doesn't make any assertions about what should happen as a result of that, then, well, hey, you've increased the coverage, but you haven't actually done anything useful. So I don't tend to use code coverage myself. There were bugs for a long time in Xcode 3 that stopped GCov from actually producing any output, which made it next to pointless as well. So it's something that I choose not to do.
So there.
Absolutely. And the horse you rode in on.
There's a new way of insult, having half the insult and trying to guess.
Right. Well, I think we should probably stop telling people too much more about unit testing, or they won't want to buy the course.
Absolutely.
And we'll both be poor, and we'll die.
What do you mean we will be poor?
We'll be poorer, and we won't be able to feed ourselves or our families, and children will die. And you'll be
more mopo.
Yeah, and more rabbits will have to die.
Yes, more of Chris Walters' rabbits.
Yes, so I think it's time to stop there. Right, okay. We've covered the white iPhone in the non-event that that's going to be. We've had a great discussion on unit testing. I sort of love talking about this sort of stuff. I have to say my enthusiasm for unit testing is greater than my implementation of unit testing, which I think is probably quite common. But it's every application where I've at least done some of it, I've always come back to it later on in life and been, really thankful. And I've never wished I'd written less unit tests, ever. When I come out, if I ever wished, I wish I'd written less unit tests, because it's always been, the more there are, and of quality unit tests, they are. Right, okay, have we got anything that we really must cover today? John, if you know of anything we must cover today, or are we done?
No, I think we've had reasonable coverage.
Good, and we've got a couple of things lined up for the next couple of weeks to give people some decent content, we hope. We're still trying to coordinate to get the people together for that, but a few interesting talks coming up. So let's start with you, John. Remind people where they can hear more of your wisdom, find out a little bit more about you, tell them where they can buy Memory Miner and why they should buy Memory Miner, anything you want to say. You've got a couple of seconds.
Okay. Well, you can find out all about my product Memory Miner at memoryminer.com. I've actually written what I thought is a fairly interesting blog post. So if you go to memoryminer.com/blog, you'll find there. And although I've mentioned it on the prior podcast, since none of them gone out, only the lucky few have listened online have been able to hear it. But I am doing this little project where I'm collecting materials, audio recordings, still photos from the experience of taking mass transit in different countries. It's actually a fairly interesting thing to look at. And since I know that we have an international audience, I would love for people who listen to this, go to memoryminer.com/blog, read that post about it, and please consider participating. I promise you it will be amusing to look at once we've assembled all the materials.
I promise you I will put it in the show notes this time, John. In fact, I will produce show notes as the first promise.
Oh, right.
And then I will put the link to your blog in those show notes.
You mean you'll produce a show and then you'll produce show notes?
Yeah, we've got. There's no. I've had some show notes for the last couple of weeks. I just haven't produced a show, but there we are.
And if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Djembe, DJEMBE, like the West African drum.
Yeah, we're like one of those football teams at the bottom of the Premier League at the moment, where they say, you know, it's been, you know, 874 minutes without a goal. Mm. I think we're one of those people who, you know, 642 minutes of broadcasting without a release. This week we're hopefully going to get there.
You know, that's
early enough.
Yeah, I was just about to call you David, but that would be pretty stupid because it's not your name.
Yeah.
So Graham, tell people that you are not called David and where they can find you.
Yeah, my name is David Lee, and my company is called Fuzzy Aliens. That's at fuzzyaliens.com, security consultancy for app developers. And I'm on Twitter at IamLeague. That's IamLeeg.
Oh, that it?
Boo, yes.
There we are. Thank you, David. Graham, Fuzzy, whatever you're called. And I'm Scotty. I'm from iDeveloper TV, the people who produce this excellence that is currently entertaining and stimulating your ears and your brain and any other bits of your body you may be holding things to. And you can follow me at...
Not while he's wearing a robe, please.
Twitter at... MacDevNet, I think that's it, yeah, MacDevNet. Check us out at iDeveloper TV. You should be seeing our new courses coming out soon, the unit testing one, funnily enough, one on QuickTimes in post-production. The NS conference videos are about to hit the scene as well in the next couple of weeks. I'm not going to go any more specific than that, hopefully, than that. And next week, we will be seeing you, and we will maybe all sat here with our brand new iPhone 4s. Purple.
You think purple is the way they're going to go?
I think purple is the way they're going to go.
Everybody wait. Can I offer one more excuse about why I missed the train when I was trying to go to NS conference?
Oh, go on then, John. One more. No, excuse.
I was stunned by this guy, and I forgot his name, but he was showing me his homemade iPhone, white iPhone. It was god awful, but it was so amusing to look at. So,
did you get photos?
No, I didn't. But you know the thing
then it
that
didn't
I,
happen.
Shut up. It did happen. And speaking of photos, that's what, from what I understand, wasn't that one of the big hardware problems that unfortunately White had the tendency of letting in a lot of light around the sensor, and so you couldn't take pictures with it. And he demonstrated it. It's like, yeah. And honestly, I don't know why this guy would do it. It's like he had a perfectly nice phone, and he trashed it for the sake of making it white. It's like, what the FU something.
But talking about trashing things and stuff like that, I have no idea what it says. And we'll talk about this next week, but I'm just giving people warnings so that they can think about it. Adobe have sort of been releasing and giving details on their stuff for releasing iPad magazines, haven't they? And apparently the cheapest you're going to be able to do it for is about £7,000 a year.
Oh, that's cheap.
To go through this using InDesign in this iPad magazine developer plugin and whatever else. So we'll talk about that. I want iPhone Flower Power Edition, says a Nick Cursor. Well, there we are. Send us your iPhone and we will
we'll
use
flower
our
it up.
Best our best techniques to give you the Flower Power iDeveloper TV Edition, and we'll even put it in a little white robe and send it back to you. There we are. Until next time, thank you to the chat room for asking some great questions. For those listening on the feeds, well, I bet you're glad that we're back in your ears. That's great. We've had a great time online, and you've been missing us, so why not join us online one day? It's usually at 10 a.m. Pacific time or 6 p.m. English time, British summer time at the moment, usually a Monday unless we decide to not do it and do it a different day. We're great to listen to online if you can find us. That's what they say. So until next time, you all take care.